You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Sarah Rose Nordgren. Sarah Rose, thanks for being with me today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Sarah Rose, let's talk about what you're working on now. I know it's probably a number of things, but what are you currently involved in as a writer?
So right now I'm working on, I'm currently in my last year of a PhD program in poetry at the University of Cincinnati. And so I'm working on my dissertation for that program, which will also be my third book of poems. And so that book is very different for me as a poet compared to the two books that I've already written, in that it's a hybrid genre work. My first two books, Beth Bones and Darwin's Mother, were both pretty standard poems in verse with a couple prose poems here and there. But this book, which has the working title of The Creation Museum, is going to be really a combination of different things that I'm experimenting with, which is exciting because I don't really know how it's going to come together. But it's going to have prose poems and also some visual essays in it, as well as maybe a handful of poems in verse. But I'm working with a number of themes in the book, kind of taking the idea of the diorama as its central sort of icon or metaphor. I have some poems that are actually about diorama, specifically a series called Diorama, where I've sort of come up with these imagined dioramas that I describe in a series of prose poems, but then also poems about literal, real-world dioramas in the Natural History Museum in New York and in the Creation Museum, which is in Kentucky, very near where I live in Cincinnati, and is a museum, quote-unquote, created by biblical creationists who believe that the earth is only 6,000 years old. And so the museum is full of all of these really expensive exhibits about sort of presenting the Bible as natural history. So there's some writing in the book about that as well.
And that's the title you're taking for your dissertation or book, is The Creation Museum?
Yes, exactly. And that's the name of that Biblical Creationist Museum in Kentucky. But I also just like the phrase so much. I feel like it's resonant in a lot of different directions, that it not only applies to that museum, but it applies to larger themes that I'm thinking about having to do with nature and artifice and technology. And it also has to do with the body, because I just recently became a mother. I have a one-year-old son. And so I'm also thinking,
Thank you.
So also there's some poems in the book having to do with motherhood and pregnancy and sort of the body as this creative force.
You are the Creation Museum.
Yeah, exactly.
As a mother,
right? Exactly. And in kind of like the opposite of a creation museum, kind of, or the anti-museum, because you can't ever see what's going on inside of you when you're creating, whereas a museum is sort of set up to be viewed. Anyway, the title of Creation Museum ended up just being resonant for me in a lot of different things that I was talking about, but it does also refer specifically to that Biblical Creation Museum in Kentucky, which is really a trip to visit.
I imagine it is. I grew up going to the Museum of Natural History in New York, and those dioramas are also this kind of antiquated but fascinating way of illustrating and bringing these scenes to life. That was, of course, before video and images,
right?
Maybe not before images, but it's really a kind of antiquated form, but still somehow so compelling.
Absolutely, and I love that museum so much, and I think that I've been going there whenever I'm in New York since my college days. I went to college in the well, it's Sarah Lawrence, which is adjacent to the city. But so I've been in love with that museum for years. And the cool thing about those dioramas and about dioramas, natural history dioramas in general, is that even though they are antiquated, there's so much amazing technology and artistry that goes into creating them. And so I've really enjoyed learning more about diorama technology and taxidermy and all of the things that go into creating something that is meant to represent something in nature. But there's all of this technology involved in creating it, just having to do with perspective. I mean, there's the actual nitty-gritty of like how you taxidermy an animal, and they create these full-scale molds of these animals that they cover with the fur. But then also just the way that the backgrounds are laid out, the way that the landscape and the ground is laid out to create a certain kind of perspective and distance, and there's an ideal position at which they imagine the viewer is viewing the diorama. Anyway, there's a lot of thought that goes into and technology that goes into something that is now antiquated, but as you said, still really, I think, compelling to people. I mean, I don't know how many yearly visitors the Natural History Museum gets in New York, but I'm sure it's a lot.
Well, I'm sure it is, too, because it's, you know, like the size of 10 football fields or something. It's just an enormous
right.
place.
It is.
I mean, that's actually where... I used to bring my child, you know, from the age of like, I don't know, infant to maybe 4 or 5 years old, almost every day going there. It's such a kind of fascinating place. So
I would love to be able to do that. I'm a little far to go there every day, but
yeah, it's a wonderful place for kids. So I know you're going to read some of your poems today. I just wanted to ask you, you're a poet, a teacher, and also referred to as a multi-form text artist. What do you mean by multi-form text artist?
Good question. I've played with a couple of different names for that, but I like multi-form because I've also thought about, you know, multi-genre or inter-genre, but I use form because I'm working outside of writing, so it's not just like hybrid genre, like the book that I just described, the Creation Museum, where I might be, you know, mixing essay with poetry or something like that. But the past few years, I've been working in active collaboration with one artist in particular, Kathleen Kelly, who is a video and dance artist. And we have a number of projects that we've created together that use video and dance. We've made a few at this point, poetry videos or poetry dance videos, but also we created a full performance installation that utilized interactive video, touchscreen technology, live interactive dance that premiered a couple of falls ago in Brooklyn. So, and then I also have a budding collaboration with another artist, Sarah Miner, who's an essayist and a visual artist, and we're working on a kind of sculptural book together. So anyway, so the multi-form, I think, comes from my interest in both technological forms like video and web art and literature, and then also my interest in materiality, which I don't really get to experiment with a lot as a writer because I'm usually with a notebook or a computer, solitary in a room. But I really am interested in physical material and how writing interacts with the objects in our environment. And so my way of pursuing that so far has been to work in collaboration with other artists that I resonate with that can contribute ideas and also allow access for me to forms that I don't have as much experience with, but I have ideas for, so I can sort of utilize other people's expertise and other people's ideas.
That makes sense. And of course, they can use yours as well. I mean, I would think for visual artists especially, there's always this or this is my notion anyway, that visual artists want to make something that's ideally poetic, you know, or
yes.
magical, and that term may mean something different to visual artists than it does to you, but
right.
you know, it's we understand what they mean. Something beautiful, something subtle,
right.
something evocative, right?
Right,
And it's also one of those things where, as a visual artist, you can say this is a poetic installation, or this is a, you know, it's kind of like saying this is my piece of magic or something. But working
right.
with a poet, for an artist, I would think, you know, takes the onus off of them of having to come up with this poetic gesture or aesthetic, and allows you to do that work.
Absolutely.
Which you're comfortable
and
with,
I think,
which you're more comfortable with, right? Yeah.
Totally. And I think, you know, there are visual artists that I think have used text successfully in their work, but I also think that a lot of times text is, you know, that there's also been some visual art where the text is not as successful. And so I think, I mean, Jenny Holzer is a great example of somebody who's a visual artist who used text extremely effectively. But not every visual artist, as you're saying, has that kind of, you know, confidence or even desire to write that, but they still want something like that as part of their piece. So I
right,
also
right.
think that like as a writer, and I think many artists are used to working alone and are, you know, oftentimes introverts and oftentimes need a lot of solitude and oftentimes need a lot of privacy in order to create. And that is also how I am. But these collaborations that I'm doing in the past few years have really been, I think, pushing my comfort zone artistically to actually share a vision with somebody else and divide labor and figure out how to proceed through a project collaboratively. And I also think that it's important for me, even just who I want to be as a person and who I want to be as a feminist, et cetera, that it's this way of sort of letting other people into the artistic process and not holding it with so tight of a grip, but having there be more play, more interchange, more compromise. And so I think that it's good for me as an artist to kind of loosen my you know, death grip of control, and also good for me just as a person.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Just like a good emotional and psychological and social sort of practice.
Right. That makes sense. And and of course, from the artist point of view that you're collaborating with as well, you know, artists, visual artists, of course, who also have the same issues of
right.
control and how do you let go and still have something successful. So I know you're going to read today. What's the first thing that you're reading?
So I was going to read a poem. It's called Material, and it's from my most recent book, Darwin's Mother. And I enjoy reading it, which is why I chose it. And just to give a little bit of context for it, the book Darwin's Mother investigates evolutionary theory and also Charles Darwin's life, but it also has some personal poems in it. But in it, I was really thinking about consciousness, what it means to be a human, our place in the natural world. You can see sort of the connections between those interests and my next project. But the poem, so it's called Material, and the poem begins with an epigraph by an Italian philosopher named Giulio Giorello. And I just love this epigraph. I love sharing it with people because it's so fantastic. I think it's actually better than the poem. But the epigraph is, yes, we have a soul, but it's made of lots of tiny robots. Okay, so here's the poem. Material. My soul rose up in me, a colony I follow. My soul has a trillion brittle wings, a billion black bodies. My soul formation is stratus. My soul's parts know little and don't care whether I live or die. Its components make a mind outside of me, hovering over the driveway. My soul is not waiting, it cannot wait. What is the sound of my soul? Incessant clicking and chattering like many sets of tiny wind-up teeth. It appears as a hurricane, sandstorm, or soot billowing. Its movable parts can arrange themselves to make a mechanical hand. My soul pulls at my soul. I am not responsible for my soul, for it acts independently. I am in awe of its cities and public works, its vast demolition projects. Every 17 years, my soul disperses after mating and litters the road with fat, crushed zeros.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, that last line, especially, is so... I don't know, it's wonderful. You know, the poem is wonderful, but that last line, the idea of demolition and reconstruction, you know, is wonderful. And also, you know, it seems that some of these things, again, and I don't know that this poem relates to it, but because it is from Darwin's mother's book, mm-hmm. and you talked about the Creation Museum, it kind of, in a kind of not indirect way, seems to almost make reference to that, because the book itself does, in some ways.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think all my interests are oftentimes of a piece. I'm interested in the relationship between, you know, nature and artifice. I'm interested in biology. I'm interested in humans' place in our environment and sort of what it means to be a human. And I'm also very interested in just sort of how things come to be, which is why I first became interested in science. But in this poem, I was inspired by the epigraph, this idea that the soul is composed of lots of tiny robots. But obviously that... that quotation is really about the phenomenon of emergence. And that's something that we see, obviously, in nature with, you know, swarms of insects or birds. And it's something that we see in consciousness. And that's, you know, what scientists and, you know, people who study theory of mind believe, that our consciousness is an emergent phenomenon. And it's also something that we see in technology with the internet and the way that
What does that mean, emergent phenomenon? What do you mean by emergent phenomenon?
The idea that lots of small things actually come together to create one big movement or one larger sort of being or phenomenon or force that has its own intelligence, but it's created out of the sum of these tiny little minds, none of which, like, you know, ant building an ant hill or something like that, where not any one of the ants actually knows what it's doing or could take on the project or be the manager of it. But somehow it's like a hive mind, right? It's the idea that these tiny little components are coming to, you know, whether they're neurons or, you know, synapses or ants or birds, have a collective mind that they share that can do what any individual can't do on their own. And I think it's a beautiful idea, and I'm extremely compelled by the idea that we see this phenomenon happening on so many different scales in our world, in both the natural world and in the technological world. So I'm really interested in parallels between our sort of natural analog world and the digital world.
And what is the next poem that you'll be reading?
So the next poem is another poem from Darwin's mother, and it's called Cicada, which is, you know, I didn't even plan the fact that last poem was kind of about cicadas too, but it's, let's see, what do you need to know about this poem? It's written. It's a persona poem written from the perspective of a mother cicada, and in it appears Charles Darwin's daughter Annie, who died at the age of 10, and it was a really significant event for Charles Darwin in his life because she was, well, obviously, the death of a child would be significant for any parent. Several of his children died in infancy or childhood, but she was really, she was his oldest daughter, and she was really his favorite. So she appears in the poem, and I think that's all you need to know, so I'll just read it. It's called Cicada. For 4 years, my daughter has been sleeping among the other daughters. She nurses in her sleep like the others too, sucking tree roots and turning her black head down in the dirt. My daughter waits to be chosen, death-like, indistinguishable from the brood in her lacy bunting with eyes shut tight. I waited like her back when all of me fit in a walnut, and Darwin's daughter lay on the grass dreaming a daughter's dream with her ankles crossed. Under her body, underground, we hundreds of daughters envied her weight. We felt her above us like a mother, though she was only another daughter. And then the next month, she stopped breathing and went all dry and veiny like a wing.
Thank you. Yeah, that's a beautiful one. And of course, also in the context of the others.
Yes. Yeah, and that one is, you know, it's sort of, it's a weird one. I feel like I always have to preface it by telling people that it's in the voice of a mother cicada because, it's one of these poems. I write a lot in persona, particularly in my first book. I think I do it a little less now than I used to, but my experience of writing in persona is not that I would sit down and say, oh, I'm going to write a poem in the voice of blank. It's more that I would just sit down to write a poem and then realize a couple of lines in, like, who is this? And then, and then it might end up being, well, when I ask myself who is speaking, it is just happens to be a mother cicada, and that's kind of strange, but I guess I'll just go with it.
Right. Well, thank you. I like that one. And you're going to read us one more, right? Is this from your dissertation or another book?
Yeah. So this last poem that I'm going to read is from the Creation Museum. So it's the dissertation / third book that I'm working on right now. And I thought I would read it. I think it's a little bit of a fun poem. It's a prose poem, and it applies to some of the things we've been talking about with motherhood, but also is about poetry writing. So it's called Making a Baby. And again, it's a prose poem. Making a Baby. Making a baby is not like making a poem, though it's true they both can form unbidden. True that the world is required. Think of it this way. You can get a good start, but you can't dredge up a whole baby on a winter morning when struck by a mood. Also, while both are known to approach the light head first, a baby's head is larger, domed and mute as a sponge pudding. And unlike verse, which parades across the white in a trail of singing ants, the infant is discreet. She keeps her alphabet tucked deep inside her veins, a shiv in the sleeve. Of the one, you can make many, of the other, probably few. In both cases, you will feel as if a shining fish were lodged in your throat and will beg for the sharpest hook to retrieve it.
Thank you. Now that was more enigmatic. Tell me a little bit about that poem and the context of it.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think I wrote it. I believe I wrote this poem while I was pregnant. So it was before I had actually had the experience of giving birth. But I was thinking about the fact that people often use birth metaphors to talk about writing. And many female writers have done this, but even male writers have done this. But if you think about, you know, even a classic poem like An Author to Her Book by Anne Bradstreet, that really is built around this idea that that books are that books of poems are children, or poems are children, and they're sort of unruly and they're lopsided, but you have to give them out to the world. There's a lot of talk of books and writing as being, you're giving birth to a book, or the book is your baby, or the book, you're sending the book out to the world. And so I think I was, you know, as a poet who happened to be pregnant at the time, I was sort of playing with this idea and arguing against it a little bit, right? Saying like, you know, actually they're not the same, but here are some ways in which they're the same. And I think the ending of the poem, which I do sort of compare the two, is this idea of both being a feeling, both involving a feeling of being, of having something lodged inside of you that you need to get out. So that's the shining fish lodged in your throat and will beg for the sharpest hook to retrieve it. And for me, that's kind of that's a dark image, right? Because, I mean, it's a little playful, but it's also dark because you don't really want somebody to retrieve your baby out of you with a sharp hook.
Right.
So I think there's a little violence there at the end of the poem as well. I wouldn't mind if somebody pulled a poem out of me with a sharp hook, but I wouldn't want them to pull a baby out of me with a sharp hook.
Right. But it's part of the fear of also that you have before giving birth, which is when that was written, you're saying.
Right, exactly. Right. You know, you do have this feeling, I mean, I think a lot of women do when they're pregnant, that's sort of like, well, it's like, this is going to have to come out of me some way. You can't, you know.
Right, but it seems like an impossibility. I remember my wife felt like, how could this possibly happen? You know?
It just
seems like.
You know that the human race only exists because it is possible, but yet it can at times feel really impossible.
Well, thank you for reading that one and the others. Before we go, I wanted to ask everyone, what are you reading at the moment, if I can ask that?
Sure. I'm kind of reading all over the place right now, but I have a few things on my nightstand. And one of the things that I've been reading the past couple of weeks is, so I have a big stack of books on my nightstand, many of which are poetry books by friends and acquaintances, many of whom are women. And I found a little collection of books right now on my nightstand of recent poetry books by poets who are also mothers. And one of them is Every Room in the Body by Carrie French. And that's a really beautiful poetry book that explores her experience having a high-risk pregnancy and a particular medical condition during her first pregnancy where there was a pretty high chance that she would lose her baby at some point. And so it's a really beautiful book, really thinking a lot about not just motherhood, but also death and what it means to be sort of a body in this kind of precarious place. Another is a recent chapbook by Adra Rain called Want Catcher. And it is really the subtitle of the book is A Record of Pregnant Writing. It's a book of prose poems by and large, but it catalogs her pregnancy week by week. So she has a prose poem for each week of her pregnancy, and it's really compelling. It's like reading somebody, you know, the journal of somebody who is really funny and smart. And so I got that book in the mail, and I sat down with it in my living room just to sort of flip through it and see what it was all about, and I didn't get back up out of the chair until I finished reading it. It didn't take that long to read because it's a chapbook, but it was very compelling and really drew me in. And then the third is Let's All Die Happy by Erin Adair Hodges. She won the 2016 Agnes Lynch Stair Poetry Prize from University of Pittsburgh Press, which is the same prize that I won for my first book. So I was interested in reading hers. And it's a really funny collection and has some great poems about motherhood in it, too, though the whole book is not about that. But it's just, it's very sassy and sad, and she just has really great emotional range. So I guess I'm interested, as a new mother myself, I'm interested in how other writers who are my age are writing about and thinking about motherhood in their poems.
I love that. Sarah Rosa, I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure hearing about your work and hearing you read poems, and I want to wish you the best on your dissertation and book that you're doing now.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.